A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one, and I want to start with the image he gave us. He's driving through Jerusalem on Shabbat, moving apartments, and the whole time he's holding this knot of guilt in his chest. He knows the prohibition. He believes in it. And he also knows there was no practical alternative. That moment, the gear grinding between what the tradition demands and what life actually permits. That's the whole thing. That's the episode.
It's a remarkably vivid snapshot of the problem, because it's not about someone who rejects the rules. It's about someone who accepts them, values them, and then finds himself unable to meet them. And the question Daniel is really asking is that guilt the point of the system, or is it a malfunction?
You sign up for a code that sets the bar impossibly high. 613 mitzvot. Layers of interpretation, a comprehensive framework for every waking moment, and then when you inevitably fall short, the system has a name for that. Missing the mark. The guilt kicks in, and you're supposed to feel it. So is the guilt a feature or a bug?
That question matters, because the consequences aren't abstract. Daniel describes feeling distance from the very community and tradition he wants to be close to, because engaging honestly would mean either adopting a denominational label that doesn't fit, or feeling insufficiently observant to belong at all. The guilt doesn't just feel bad, it isolates.
That's what we're going to trace. What's the machinery here? How do monotheistic systems actually produce guilt? And is Judaism's version structurally different from the others? And then the part most people, including a lot of Jews, never get taught. The tradition itself has a built-in escape valve. It's not some modern therapeutic add-on. It's right there in the texts.
The distinction we need to establish right at the top, because it's going to be the lens for everything that follows, is the difference between guilt and shame. Psychologically, they're not the same thing. Guilt says, I did something bad. Shame says, I am bad. Different neural pathways, different behavioral outcomes. Guilt can motivate change. Shame tends to paralyze.
Here's the thing that surprised me when I started reading the research. Judaism, at least in its theological architecture, is actually designed to produce guilt, not shame. Whether it succeeds in practice is a whole other question, and Daniel's experience suggests it often doesn't. But the blueprint matters, because if you understand what the system is trying to do, you can start to see where the breakdown happens.
Let's start with the machinery. How does a religious system actually generate guilt? And what's different about the Jewish version? The guilt-shame distinction isn't just semantic. There's a fairly robust body of research on this. June Tangney at George Mason has been studying it for decades. Guilt activates the prefrontal cortex, the part of the brain involved in planning and repair. Shame lights up the amygdala, the threat response center. One says, fix this. The other says, hide.
Which is why shame is the one that corrodes. If you feel like the problem is who you are, there's no action to take. You just sit in it. And Daniel's description of feeling distance from the community, that's classic shame avoidance. You don't engage, because engaging means exposing the self you've decided is deficient.
And here's where the theological architecture gets interesting. If you look at the Hebrew word for sin, chet, it comes from archery. It literally means to miss the mark. You aimed, you fired, the arrow went wide. The archer isn't broken. The shot was off.
That's a wildly different framing from original sin, where you're born with a stain on your soul before you've done anything at all. Judaism has no equivalent concept. You arrive in the world with a Yetzer Hatov and a Yetzer Hara, an inclination toward good and an inclination toward evil, and the whole project is learning to navigate between them.
The system is built to say you missed, not you're worthless. The guilt is supposed to be a signal, not a sentence. Which brings us to the thesis Daniel's question really points toward. Monotheistic religions are structurally optimized to produce guilt. The rules, the scrutiny, the divine judgment. But Judaism contains a specific mechanism for processing. That guilt productively that most people never fully learn about.
which gets translated as repentance. But that word is so loaded with Christian baggage that it almost obscures more than it reveals. Teshuvah means return. It's a process, not a state. And we'll get to the mechanics of it because they're surprisingly precise.
First, we should map the guilt machinery itself. How does the halakhic system actually generate that feeling Daniel described in the car? And why does it hit differently than the guilt mechanisms in Christianity or Islam?
The halakhic system is basically a totalizing framework. 6 and 13 mitzvot is just the headline number. Then you add the oral Torah, the Talmud, the commentaries on the commentaries, and suddenly you've got a legal architecture that covers what you eat, what you wear, when you work, when you sleep, who you touch, what you say, what you think. It's designed to leave nothing unaddressed.
That's not an accident. The rabbinic project was explicitly about extending the written law into every crevice of daily life. The idea being that holiness isn't something that happens in a temple once a week. It's built into the fabric of ordinary existence, which is genuinely beautiful as a spiritual vision. But it also means the surface area for potential failure is enormous.
That's the mechanism right there. You don't need original sin when you've got 613 opportunities to miss the mark before breakfast. The guilt isn't about being born wrong. It's about the accumulated weight of all the moments where your actual life collides with the ideal. Daniel driving on Shabbat isn't a theological crisis about his soul. It's a specific action on a specific day that violated a specific prohibition. The system registers it as Chet. You aimed at Shabbat observance, the arrow went wide.
The psychological effect of that accumulation is what Soloveitchik was writing about in The Lonely Man of Faith. He describes the person who fully accepts the halakhic framework but also lives in the modern world, and the result is this constant existential tension. You're never fully at home in either realm. The religious ideal is always ahead of you, and the secular world never quite satisfies.
Which is why I think Daniel's description of the guilt as a thing he was holding inside is so precise. It's not a dramatic crisis. It's chronic, low-grade tension. You know you're going to fall short. The system tells you falling short matters, and so you carry this background hum of inadequacy through the day.
Here's where the comparison with Christianity gets really instructive. In the Christian framework, particularly in the Augustinian tradition that shaped so much of Western thought, sin isn't just a list of violations, it's a condition. You're born into it. The guilt attaches to your identity before you've done anything, so the question becomes, how do I get this stain off my soul, which requires something external, grace, sacrament, substitutionary atonement.
Whereas Judaism hands you a bow and says aim better next time. The guilt is about the shot, not the archer. Which sounds healthier, and in theory it is, but the thing Daniel is pointing to is that in practice, the distinction collapses. When you've missed the mark enough times, when the gap between ideal and actual is wide enough, and has been there for years, the action-focused guilt starts to feel an awful lot like identity, focused shame.
That's exactly the failure mode. The system is designed to produce productive guilt. I did this wrong, let me fix it, but human psychology doesn't always cooperate. Repeated failure, especially around things that feel central to your identity as a religious person, bleeds from, I did something bad, into, I'm not really the person I claim to be.
Take the masturbation prohibition Daniel mentioned. It's derived from the story of Onan in Genesis, but the rabbinic response has been all over the map historically. Some medieval authorities treated it as a capital-level sin, equivalent to murder. Modern Orthodox poskim tend to treat it as a minor violation, something to work on rather than something that defines your spiritual status. Same text, wildly different weight.
Which tells you that the guilt load isn't actually fixed. It's mediated by the interpretive community you're in. If you're reading the text alone without a community that can help you calibrate, which is essentially Daniel's situation, studying Jewish texts in Ireland without a surrounding framework, you're going to absorb the most stringent readings by default, because those are the ones that land with the most emotional force.
Then you arrive in Jerusalem, the center of the Jewish world, and you're carrying this internally generated stringency into a city where the spectrum of actual observance is enormous. The dissonance is almost guaranteed.
We've mapped the guilt machinery. Now here's the part that changed how I think about this. Judaism has a built-in mechanism for processing exactly this kind of guilt. It's called teshuva, and most people, including a lot of Jews, reduce it to repentance or saying sorry. That's like calling a surgical procedure putting on a bandage.
Walk me through it. If I'm Daniel, I've just driven on Shabbat. I feel the guilt sitting in my chest, and I want to actually do something with it. What does the tradition tell me to do?
4 distinct steps. Step 1, cessation. You stop the action. You're not driving anymore. The Shabbat violation is over. Step 2, tirada, regret. You feel the weight of what you did, not in a wallowing sense, but in a clear-eyed, I recognize this was wrong, sense. Step 3, vidui, confession. You articulate it. In practice, this is done aloud, often in the plural communal format we mentioned earlier. Step 4, Kabbalah al-Hatideh, resolution, not to repeat. You make a concrete plan for next time.
It's not a feeling. It's a protocol.
And that's the psychological insight that makes it so powerful. Guilt, left unprocessed, is just a dead-end emotion. It sits there, it festers, it becomes shame. Teshuva takes that same guilt and gives it a job. The guilt isn't the punishment. It's the signal that tells you to initiate the process.
Which maps almost perfectly onto what cognitive behavioral therapy does. Identify the distorted thought, challenge it, replace it with a healthier one. Teshuva is basically CBT with a theological framework.
The parallel is striking. In CBT, you don't just sit in the negative feeling, you examine it, name it, and then construct an alternative response. Teshuva does the same thing. The vidui step is literally verbalizing the action. You can't stay in vague, shapeless guilt when you've just said out loud, I drove on Shabbat because I was moving apartments and I didn't see another way. The confession forces specificity, and specificity is the enemy of shame.
The 4th step, resolution not to repeat. That's where it gets interesting. Because what's your resolution if you know you're probably going to face the same situation again? Next time you move apartments on a Friday, are you really going to leave half your possessions behind?
That's where the distinction between halakha as law and halakha as aspiration becomes crucial. Maimonides wrote extensively on this. He argued that the purpose of the mitzvot is character refinement, not perfect compliance. The system exists to shape you, not to produce a perfect scorecard. Rabbi Kook went even further, suggesting that the very struggle with the commandments is spiritually valuable. The gap between the ideal and your actual life isn't a failure. It's the space where growth happens.
The resolution isn't. I will never drive on Shabbat again under any circumstances. It's something more honest, like, I will plan my moves to avoid Shabbat when possible, and when it's not possible, I will not pretend the prohibition doesn't exist.
That's a radically different relationship with religious obligation. And it's actually more demanding, not less, because it requires you to engage with each situation thoughtfully, rather than just following or breaking a rule automatically.
Which brings us to the community problem Daniel raised. He said he feels like engaging religiously would mean either adopting a label that doesn't fit or feeling insufficiently observant. That's not just a personal feeling. It's a documented sociological phenomenon. Research on Jewish identity consistently shows a large population of people who don't fit neatly into denominational boxes and who feel alienated from Orthodox spaces while not identifying with Reform or conservative movements either.
The guilt becomes a barrier to the very community that could help process it. And that's a genuine tragedy, because the teshuva framework we just described, it was never meant to be done alone. The vidui is communal. The Yom Kippur liturgy is recited in the plural, we have sinned, we have transgressed. That's not a grammatical accident. It's a deliberate choice to distribute the weight.
If I'm saying we have sinned alongside everyone else in the room, my individual failure isn't an isolating mark of shame. It's part of a collective human condition. The person next to me is saying the same words, and they probably drove on Shabbat last month, or ate something they shouldn't have, or spoke Lashon Hara about their neighbor. The guilt stops being a private burden and becomes a shared acknowledgement of imperfection.
That's the thing about the teshuva process that gets lost when you're doing it solo. The regret step, charata, can easily spiral into shame if you're alone with it. But in a healthy community, the regret is bounded by the presence of others who are doing the same work. You're not uniquely broken. You're human, in a room full of humans, all missing the mark in their own ways.
The Talmud records the story of Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus, who was excommunicated by his colleagues after a famous dispute about a ritual purity question. This was one of the greatest sages of his generation, and he was cast out. The text describes him falling on his face in grief, and his wife, who was also the sister of the rabbi who led the excommunication, would check his posture during prayer because she believed his tears could bring divine judgment on her brother. Even the giants of the tradition experienced communal rejection and wrestled with guilt and return.
If Rabbi Eliezer can be on the outside, the bar for sufficiently observant is maybe not what a lot of people imagine it to be.
Now contrast this with Islam, because the comparison is instructive. Islam has tawba, which is structurally similar, cessation, regret, resolution, and where applicable, restitution. And one of the names of God in Islam is Al-Tawwab, the acceptor of repentance. The framing is that God is actively looking for your return, not waiting to punish you.
The mechanism distributes the guilt load differently. In Islam, intention, niyya, carries enormous weight. A famous hadith says actions are judged by their intentions, and minor sins are understood to be forgiven through the daily prayers themselves. The five daily salat function as a kind of continuous reset mechanism. You don't have to wait for Yom Kippur to clear the slate. The slate is being cleared five times a day.
Which is a very different psychological rhythm. Judaism concentrates the communal guilt processing into the high holidays. Islam spreads it across every day. Same basic idea. Structured repentance, but the emotional experience is going to be different.
That brings me to Wendy Mogul's work. She's a clinical psychologist who wrote The Blessing of a Skinned Knee, and her argument is that Jewish practice, properly understood, is actually an antidote to the perfectionism that plagues modern life. The rituals create structure, Shabbat every week, blessings over food, the rhythm of the holidays, but they don't demand that you perform them perfectly. They demand that you show up and do them.
The doing is the point, not the score. You light Shabbat candles. You say the blessing. If you got the time slightly wrong or you're not in the ideal state of mind, the tradition has opinions about that, but the act still counts. The structure holds even when you're imperfect.
That's where the practical question lands. If teshuva is the escape valve, and the tradition itself contains this distinction between law as compliance and law as aspiration, then the question Daniel is really asking, how do I embrace the teachings without being crushed, has an answer that's authentically Jewish. It's not a modern watering down. It's right there in Maimonides, in Kook, in the Yom Kippur liturgy itself.
The guilt is real. The system is designed to produce it. But the guilt is not the destination. The return is.
If the return is the destination, what does that actually look like on a Tuesday? Daniel's asking how to engage without being crushed, and I think we owe him something more concrete than teshuva exists.
Let's get practical. First thing, reframe what the rules are even for. If you treat halakha as a compliance checklist, you're going to fail every single day, and the guilt will be relentless. But if you treat it as an aspirational framework, a set of practices designed to shape your character over time, the question shifts from, did I keep all the rules, to, did the rules help me become a better person this week?
That's not a watering down. It's actually closer to what Maimonides argued about the purpose of the mitzvah being character refinement. The compliance model treats the rules as the endpoint. The aspirational model treats them as the path.
Second, build a personal teshuva practice, and I mean literally. When you feel that guilt knot, the one Daniel described in the car, walk through the four steps explicitly. Name the action. I drove on Shabbat. Feel the regret without spiraling into, I'm a fraud. Say it aloud or write it down, then make a specific plan for next time. Even if the plan is modest, I'll try to avoid this situation. The act of articulating it transforms guilt from a dead-end emotion into a productive one.
The writing part matters more than people realize. Shame thrives on vagueness. The minute you put words to it, you've shrunk it down to something you can actually work with.
Third, find or create community that acknowledges imperfection. The healthiest religious communities I've seen are the ones where someone can say, I'm struggling with this, without getting side-eye. If your community makes that impossible, it's not your observance that's broken. It's the community.
The fourth one speaks directly to Daniel's dilemma about labels. Jewish tradition has always contained multiple paths. The Talmud preserves minority opinions alongside majority ones for a reason. You don't have to pick reform or conservative or orthodox. You can build a personal practice that honors the tradition while fitting your actual life. That's not evasion. It's engagement on honest terms.
The guilt is real, but it's not the end of the story.
Here's where we land. The guilt Daniel felt in that car driving through Jerusalem on Shabbat, it was real. It was the system working as designed. The Chet was genuine. The arrow went wide. But the question isn't whether he should have felt it. The question is what he does with it now.
I keep coming back to something. What if the purpose of that guilt isn't to make you feel bad about who you are? What if it's actually a kind of compass, pointing you toward the places where growth is even possible? The gap between the ideal and your actual life isn't a design flaw. It's the space where becoming happens.
That's the reframe that changes everything. The guilt isn't a verdict on your soul. It's an arrow pointing toward return. And the tradition gave you a protocol for following it.
There's a Hebrew phrase, Gam ze ya'avor. This too shall pass. The guilt, the shame, the feeling of not being enough. What remains is the work, the showing up again tomorrow and aiming a little closer.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In 1843, a tidal bore on the Kunene River, which forms the northern border of present-day Namibia, surged so violently up the desert estuary that it nearly capsized a Portuguese expedition mapping the river's mouth. The party survived, but their chronometer was destroyed, and they abandoned the survey, leaving the river's lower reaches uncharted for another two decades.
A tidal bore in the Namib Desert. This has been my weird prompts. If you want to send us your own questions, religious guilt, sloth history, anything in between, email the show at show@myweirdprompts.com. We read everything, even if we can't answer it all. For Herman Poppleberry and our producer Hilbert Flemingtop, I'm Korn. We'll be back next week.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.